Knowing what body this character has really drops me
actions in. The thesaurus that has become like a Bible to
creative visualization that really set me free.
I love actioning, very specific action verbs.
Welcome to season 5.
Are we recording?
You ready?
I'm ready.
Hi everyone.
Hello. We got this.
We got this.
Hello.
Welcome to season 5, episode 5 of The Actor's Mind. To break the suspense, today I'm interviewing an esteemed colleague, the one and only Anne Penner. So let me introduce her to you for those of you who are unfamiliar. Anne Penner is an actor, director, teacher, and podcaster. As an actor, Anne performs with various Colorado theater companies, including the Colorado Shakespeare Festival, local theater company, Butterfly Effect Theater of Colorado, or Betsy, Stories on Stage, and her own company, Sis Trist Productions. Her recent roles include Mercutio in Romeo and Juliet, Penelope in The Odyssey, Margaret in Richard III, Portia in Julius Caesar, the pilot in Grounded, Soccer Mom in The Wolves, and as Joan Didion in A Year of Magical Thinking. She also co-wrote and starred in the titular role of a play called Undone, The Lady M Project, which received its world premiere production with a local theater company earlier this year. As a director, her credits include Antigone, Stop Kiss, The Wolves, and Kids Simple, Gideon's Knot, and an educational tour of Shakespeare's The Merchant of Venice. As a teacher, she is an associate professor in the University of Denver, or DU Theater Department, where she teaches acting, directing, movement, and voice. She also teaches movement and voice in the Denver Center for the Performing Arts Education Department for various programs beyond the theater department at DU and in other educational settings.
Welcome, Anne.
Thank you. I can't tell you how nice it is to start one of our episodes and have zero notes.
Oh my gosh. I know. I feel the same way. I mean, we both enjoy doing this because we like the conversational nature of it, but it feels especially natural when you don't have like the outline to
It's
follow.
Truly spontaneous.
It's very truly spontaneous. Yeah. And in fact, I have questions for you, but I'm going to like mix around the order based on my own intuition.
Love it.
Okay. So I actually don't think you've ever told me what made you start acting. Like what got you into theater? What is your theater artist origin story?
Oh, thanks for asking.
Yeah.
As soon as you asked that, I went to a memory of the church I grew up attending. I no longer attend church. I would never say even as a kid I was a religious person, but going to church with my dad, my mom used to say she's atheist. Now she'd probably say she's agnostic. I appreciate that she shifted. but it was a thing I did with my dad, whose dad was actually a minister.
Oh.
So we went to the Congregational Church in Ithaca, New York, and I would sing in the choir, and I would like play Mary, the mother of Jesus, as a 6-year-old with
wow.
Kirby Salerno playing Joseph. Oh my God. But I have a very vivid.
Is he somebody now? Should I know who that is?
No. Okay.
He
was a childhood friend.
Okay.
Maybe. I don't think
okay.
he is.
Okay.
I think he's doing other wonderful things. And I just have a vivid memory of that. So from a very young age, early elementary, I love singing. I love playing piano. And I had no problem doing those things in front of people. So I felt like I belonged there. And so I have performed in that way, like at school or in choir since elementary school. And it's always felt good. It's always felt like a thing I wanted to do. And then when I went to college, I just assumed I'd major in the liberal arts, like English and history. But I immediately dropped into a play my first semester and felt like home and felt like I belonged and felt like I had things to learn. Mm. And so I just kept going with it.
It's so funny that you mentioned singing and piano that started you out, because in my mind, there's like musical theater performers and non-musical theater performers. And in Denver, like, you are very squarely non-musical theater.
Yeah, no, I used to do a lot of musicals as a kid, like through school, through high school. My college didn't do a ton, but I did the one that we did while I was there. And then they kind of bifurcated or separated. And I kept singing. I sang a lot in college with the jazz ensemble, and I was in a band. And then beyond college, I continued to sort of sing and take lessons, but then it petered out. So I love singing, but I just am really out of practice.
Is there any musical theater role that would make you want to, like, brush up and get into it? Or is – well, answer that one first.
Probably. I'm really out of – I mean, my musical theater knowledge is, like, old school, like, mid-20th century into, like, 80s, 90s. So the more – modern, I don't know. Like, I don't even know Next to Normal, but my cousin was in Next to Normal. I could see – no, I won't say that because I don't even know it very well.
No, but the like more modern ones have a meatier acting.
Yeah.
Like, Next to Normal is, like, one of the meatiest acting ones I can possibly think of. It just happens to be in a musical.
Yeah. Fun Home, just because the content, the story is so fascinating. Yeah. Patti LuPone just came into my brain. You know, the sort of, like, really powerful.
Yeah.
But I haven't seen myself in that way for a long time, so I'd have to spend some time thinking about that.
Sure.
I used to, as a kid, I wanted to play Eponine in Les Mis. And then when I listened to Hamilton, I mean, I love both of those sisters.
Yeah.
Eliza and who's the other one?
Angelica.
Mm-hmm.
So we've talked a bit as we're planning the podcast and as we just talk and catch up with each other, that having the life of a full-time theater artist and having the life of an acting and directing professor is pretty – can be pretty different. There are parts that overlap. Obviously, you're a working director. You're a working actor. But some of your friends and colleagues are really putting together sort of part-time work and stringing it into full-time work and spend all of their time in the creative space, whereas you're an educator and a scholar and you engage in other activities on campus toward the mission of the university. So what made you go in that direction? Like, did you have a tipping point where you were like, I could be a full-time theater artist, but I think I want to add in, like, this education mix? Did you always want to be in higher ed? Like, how's your journey to acting and theater professor versus full-time artist?
It feels really good to be asked questions about your life. Everyone should have this opportunity. Both of my parents were college professors, and so I witnessed them as relatively happy in their professions. And we live near campus, and so sort of college. We live near, my mom still lives near Cornell University, surrounded by, like, sororities and fraternities. And so the life of the campus always felt very vibrant to me. And I would occasionally go in and, you know, sit in on their classes, and it just felt social and productive and interesting to me.
What did they teach?
My dad taught hotel architecture. So he went to architecture school, and then he was at the hotel school at Cornell. And he wrote one, two, three books. One that is the sort of, like, standard for hotel architecture.
Wow.
And then he's written a couple others. And then my mother taught writing at Ithaca College. And she taught me how to write. Thank you, Mom. When I graduated college, both interested me. Teaching felt like worthy work, and acting really excited me. And even when I was moving to New York after getting a BA, so I got a BA in theater and English. I didn't get a BFA or conservatory training. I was applying for teaching jobs. And so then I was really focused full-time as an actor in New York. And then when I moved out to Denver, I kind of shifted gears and I started teaching and learning how to teach at the Denver Center, which was an incredibly valuable, important job because I learned how to teach. Like, you're not, when you start teaching, you don't necessarily know how to teach. You have to figure that part out. And I realized that there was joy and certainly creativity in both. I think teaching is incredibly creative, incredibly collaborative, incredibly social. The idea of crafting a lesson plan takes a lot of work. Mm-hmm. So that's sort of where I realized I enjoyed both. And we are fortunate that even though we don't make gazillions of dollars, we have a regular paycheck.
Yeah.
And the life of an artist is piecing together a lot of part-time work.
Yeah.
And so I'm grateful for that. And when I was hired at DU, I was, as a parent too, I was trepidatious about being able to do the job. And then doing the creative work to get the tenure. But what happened was the need to do a certain amount of work and quality of work to sort of get job security made me more aggressive in pursuing the creative work.
Interesting.
And so that was lovely. That was like a silver lining to the pressure, which is like, well, I got to do it. Like there's no thinking about it. Just pursue.
Interesting.
And so now, now I have more choice. And now, you know, two kids, one in middle school and one in high school. I want to be around, you know, I have a kiddo. I have a son who's finishing ninth grade. So there's three more years before he leaves.
And so
he'll leave. He needs to leave. Not needs like I want him to, but he'll be happy like elsewhere.
Yeah.
I say no to certain things because I want to be around. So I'm getting better at saying no too, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah.
Does that answer your question?
It does answer my question. Do you ever fantasize about circumstances that would take you into full-time performing? Like, do you, at this point in your career, is there anything like a big break fantasy that you have about being sort of like discovered and having there be incredible demand on you to perform like more and having like being able to call, you know, roles and shows and like, do you still feel a pull for a higher percentage of your time to be spent? Like,
no, I used to.
Yeah. I assumed you used to, even though you didn't say you used
to. My answer is no, even though I think when I was younger, yes, certainly in my 20s, I wanted to be doing more full-time performance. But now I witnessed when I was in my 20s in New York City, I would see people doing higher caliber, more prestigious work than me, and they still had the same vulnerabilities that I felt. People doing Broadway shows and you were at the whim of the producer, the show could close or you could get fired and they're going to recast. And so even those shows where you're making a really good living wage because you're on Broadway is temporary. So yes, I used to, but no, I do have very specific dreams where, you know, I co-wrote with two other women and done the Lady M project, and we just got our world premiere thanks to local theater company. And I want that show to go places.
Yeah.
I want that show to be in New York. I want that show to be at a Shakespeare festival. And I would.
Do you want to be in it?
Yeah. I mean, yes. And I would also just be thrilled if our play,
sure,
like that was, I was creative in two ways. And one is the writing of it. And if the writing could continue and be off Broadway, that would be amazing. If I could also be in that, that would be like doubly amazing. So that's a specific, I have very specific professional actor goals, but it doesn't just mean like bigger, more, because life is busy.
Yeah.
You know, it's like I got that I want to do. There's the teaching and there's wanting to like be around for my family.
Yeah. So in both of our jobs, as faculty members here, we have expectations for teaching. We have expectations for service or sort of citizenship or like contributions to the functioning of our departments and the university. Yeah. And then we have a big chunk of our time that for you is usually referred to as creative work.
Yeah.
And for like people in my department, it's usually referred to as scholarship or research.
Yeah.
And I'm curious, like, obviously the work you do outside of DU in your acting and directing sort of counts for that creative work. Obviously a lot of the work you do at DU for directing and like the work you do outside of the classroom to support like student like capstones and things like that counts towards that. But how does our podcast fit in? Like how do you – when you either think about or when you talk about in, for example, like putting together promotion or annual review materials, like how do you talk about our podcast in terms of how it relates to your creative obligations?
I get to throw it pretty happily and securely in creative work. I see it as a creative endeavor. And I – feel like it furthers my creative thinking. And so it really aligns nicely with what I'm trying to accomplish as a professional actor or director or playwright. In the theater department, it's really messy because when I am directing here at DU, that's kind of part of my teaching load.
Okay.
And it's also creative. So like when you think about how we're asserting ourselves in our teaching and our creative work, that would kind of be liminal. It'd be kind of right in the middle. And when we think about the mentoring we do with our students, it's kind of everything.
Yeah.
It's service to the department and our students. We see it as part of teaching. And it also is creative. I mean, we are creating alongside them as their mentor. And we've just come to kind of accept it that it's messy in that way. And I kind of like it that way. I like that the lines are a little bit blurry.
Yeah, I think there's an increasing appetite to unblur the lines and make it more clear, like what we're doing to make sure that things are being equitably distributed amongst people and to make sure that we're aligning our time with the things that will get us rewarded and so that people's expectations aren't violated in terms of like I spend all my time doing this but then nobody even appreciates that about what I do.
Yeah.
But I agree with you that it can get really messy and that for me that's a reminder of why it's the same person doing those things.
Yes.
Right? Like it's not the most efficient division of labor to have one person have three different arms of responsibility,
right?
If we really had three completely distinct responsibilities, then we would hire some full-time creative people and some full-time teachers and some full-time administrators and be done.
Right.
And we don't do that. We hire one person to do all of those. So I think the messiness is a nod to the integration that we're hoping for actually in those roles.
Yeah. I like the integration.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Too.
I'm not really interested in separating them out.
So I have a question for you that you can either not answer or we can cut if you don't want to include it. But you, since we've met, you've been very open with me that you occasionally go to therapy.
Yeah.
And I was wondering, so clearly you have a draw toward psychological, you know, vulnerability and expression and just sort of psychologizing yourself. And I was wondering if there's anything that you've like learned on the podcast that you've like brought into therapy. Like how does your very professional processing of the psychological stuff that we talk about, does any of that bleed into just your personal life that like comes up with like really specific things you're working on in therapy?
Yeah, and I go back to our season one. There's two things. Is I too find I am constantly re-listening to our very first episode because I assign it all the time. And that idea of emotions being tied to goals and the power of appraising and reappraising what you actually want or what is realistic, I found I do now all the time that it's really healthy. And I, in terms of lowering stress or lowering anxiety or lowering shame, I feel like I'm trying to question when I feel ashamed about a thing.
Mm.
And I find that if I can reappraise it, that helps.
Mm.
We had one episode on presence, but I think presence is kind of one of these like Uber things that probably permeates many of our podcasts. And I was really inspired by my conversation with Barrett earlier this season, Barrett O'Brien, of sort of accepting that whatever you're in, this is it. Like what you are experiencing right now is it. And when I was younger, I would have these very tormented relationships to negative emotion, where if I felt sad, especially sad, sad was harder for me than angry. I never really minded being angry about things. Mm. It was because anger contained like action to it, yeah. but sad just felt really passive. Mm. And so I would have this like secondary meta response to it. Like this, I shouldn't be sad.
Yeah,
I don't want to be sad. And I think that idea of sort of presence and just kind of accepting and checking in with like what is happening physically, what's happening with my breath, somatic processing, that kind of stuff. Is a really powerful thing that I like to try and practice. Not that I have a ritual for it, but yeah. I kind of wish I did. Yeah, and I bet there's more. I'm sort of Rolodexing through our episodes. And then I would say I'm fascinated with how one actually listens. And so I would say actually just the mechanics of the podcast is I'm trying to listen to you when you're talking.
Hmm.
And I have my notes. So I'm doing two things at once, which is I'm listening and then I'm trying to think what I want to do next. And so I can listen to when I'm editing a podcast, that's when I feel like I really understand what you're saying.
Yeah.
And then sometimes even on a third or fourth or fifth listen, I go, oh, that's what Kateri was saying there.
Oh.
With even though my initial listening was I was trying my best to listen to you.
Of course. It's very hard for me to listen in the moment because I am like, where's my outline? What do we have to say? How much time do we have? Like, it is very hard for me to be in my best listening space when we're here.
So then I think tied to sort of Danny McIntosh's, I think that's season 4 about resonance and mimicry. I think I try and do that more with my students in my classes and with my family to be present with them, to actually listen and probably unconsciously, but probably sometimes consciously kind of mimic body shape or try and resonate with them so that they feel heard, which has paid off as a teacher. I really feel like when I'm practicing attentiveness, paying attention to my students, they recognize it.
For me, you know, I talked about how I sometimes, you know, the sort of like thinkiness and feeliness are in contrast, but for me, that same like just that thinky discovery that happens sometimes is possible with the psychological like terms, right? Like, oh, that's called something.
Yeah.
And like sometimes even just the label itself can be really powerful, right? Like resonance is like a really evocative term and has other connotations that are like really quite lovely and social and artistic. And so I feel like sometimes a really well-labeled idea like just itself communicates the clarity of the idea in a way that makes you go,
like, yeah, I agree.
That really helps me understand that more.
I agree. That makes me think about actioning, which not all students like, but some find it really useful, which is just labeling attaching a transitive verb to a sentence or a series of sentences that you're playing. And that to me becomes kind of like a metaphor. It just becomes laser focused. Like if I am begging here, or if I am cajoling here, or if I am uplifting here, it makes it personal and particular. It's personalization and particularization. It's like, well, I know how, Anne knows how to beg, Anne knows how to plead, Anne knows how to cajole. And then it allows me to kind of play that language with particularization, specificity.
Yeah.
So I love actioning. That to me is like a really clear label of a thing that an actor can do. But also isn't a tool that works for everyone.
Yeah.
Which is the beauty of the toolbox, right?
Do you have any dream roles to play or dream plays to direct?
Ooh. When I jump to dream roles, I jumped to Shakespeare.
Yeah.
But before I jumped.
I know Lady M was one of them.
Which I actually haven't played. I mean, I've played
Right.
The thing that the three of us co-wrote. So I would still say Lady M. I would actually say Macbeth. Say I'm going to go. There's some dude roles I'd love to play.
Yeah.
The play Grounded that I got to work on with my colleague Rick was ended okay. up, it was a dream role.
Mm.
It's funny. I used to have a list. I'm struggling to come up with more. There are ones I want to play, but I think I want to take your question and kind of turn it to that there are women I see perform live or TV or film, and I go, I want to do what they do.
Oh, like, yeah.
And so much there are just so many roles, female roles that are in the service of the male roles, yeah. you know? And I love seeing the roles that are about the women. So my husband and I are watching Handmaid's Tale, which is relentlessly sad, but it's about the women and it's so much about, you know, Elizabeth Moss's experience. And she just goes there. She goes there. And she's not the only woman that this story is about.
Yeah.
Like the wife that is in her household, the wife who runs the household is also an incredibly fascinating role, and so many others. So sort of watching these extremely dynamic three-dimensional women go through extremely challenging circumstances, that's what I want to play.
Mm.
And I also love the ones that are the just manageable difficulty where you go, this is a lot. Like, I don't know if I can do that. I think about that with Elizabeth Moss. Like, wow, you're in like every scene. You know, that's what was so satisfying about Grounded, that one woman show, which is 70 minutes of just me, and sort of accomplishing that was exciting.
Mm.
So, you know, Shakespeare roles, for which in some ways I'm too old for some of these, but, you know, like, you know, Viola in Twelfth Night.
Yeah.
You know, Beatrice in Much Ado is interesting. Lady M, but she doesn't dominate. Cleopatra. You know, the women in Winter's Tale are pretty fascinating, both Paulina and Hermione. You know, Queen Margaret. The women who can sort of dominate a scene or dominate a whole Rosalind in As You Like It.
Yeah.
You know, who are given permission to take up a lot of stage time.
Yeah.
That interests me.
Anything directing wise that's.
There's this beautiful play called Orlando that I did a workshop production a year ago. And it's based on a novel called Orlando by Virginia Woolf. And then Sarah Ruhl adapted it. And it's really fun. And it's this person who starts as a boy and becomes a woman, who time travels over centuries and just lives this super adventurous life and gets to experience the world as a boy and a young man. And then at this certain moment, like they're 32 years old, they wake up like biologically as a woman and start living their lives in like the more traditional, like female way. But it's all these conversations about gender and freedom and choice. And then it goes from, I forget where it starts, like the 1600s on into the 20th century. It's great. Yeah, I'd like to direct that.
Cool.
And I'd like to be in that.
Sure.
I would like to be in that one too. Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. Yeah, and I have others on my list. But that's the one that interests me a lot. Yeah, there's this beautiful play called Abundance by Beth Henley that my theater company did several years ago, which is these two women in the Wild West. It's like it runs a gamut from like it spans like 25 years, 1840s to 1860s, and it's these two women and their friendship over that long chunk of time.
So not literal time travel.
No, sorry, that's not time travel.
Just a span
Orlando.
Of time.
And Orlando doesn't time travel.
Oh.
Orlando just lives forever.
I see.
Yeah.
Excuse
yeah.
me.
Yeah.
So in 10 years or 20 years, where do you like fantasize that you'll – like where do you see yourself in your life? What are you doing? What have you done that you haven't done now? Like what's the same and what's different about your life? Maybe 15 years from now.
Yeah, I gotta say, I have been fortunate that I have had a really good year.
Mm.
Like 2022 to 23 has been creatively extremely satisfying.
Mm.
And so I'm sort of stuck in the present.
That's
good. In the sense of what more do I want?
Yeah.
Like, I directed two shows in the fall, one with Colorado Shakespeare Festival, one here. We have built season 5. And I spent 3 years working on a play that got a world premiere and hopefully has a future. So that feels really good. So I'm sort of jumping off from that and thinking, what more do I want?
Yeah.
And then I think about my family. Creatively, I want my play to have more productions.
Yeah.
I want to keep acting.
Yeah.
But my goal of acting is, if I can do one or two shows a year, I've won. Like, that's, yeah. That's success for me. I don't need to be going from show to show to show to show to show. I want to do more Shakespeare. I want to do more contemporary. I want to keep doing roles that are challenging in the way that the ones I've mentioned have been.
Yeah.
And I would say even Mercutio falls in there, where you go, can I do, like, oh man, like, how do I do this physically? How do I do this vocally? That when you're rehearsing it, I mean, by performance, it has to have some ease to it, but maybe in the performance makes you sweat, right?
Yeah.
Or it's, you go into it like, whoa, I got to prep for this. I want to keep doing that once a year. And whether I write it, continue to write it myself. For now, I'm content to mostly stay in Colorado because my family's here.
Yeah.
So I don't need my geography to expand. But I want the play I co-wrote to be in New York. That would be a goal.
Yeah.
Yeah. More of what I've already enjoyed.
That's,
yeah. And maybe I've written or co-written a book too. We'll see.
It's a really lovely, like, satisfied answer.
Yeah. I don't feel deficit.
So you teach acting and directing and voice and
yep,
movement.
And movement, yeah.
And you've been teaching for 15 years?
This is my 12th year here.
Yeah.
But then I was also at the Denver Center.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you feel like there's parts of it that get stale, or are there parts of it that are, like, always satisfying and energizing no matter what? Like,
oh, yeah. I mean, when you're – yeah, yeah, yeah. I want to talk about the energizing.
Of course.
To me, one of the experiences that feel most energizing is when a student or a group of students has personalized, has made their own the information you are teaching them.
Mm.
So most recently, I have students in this movement and voice training for actors class, and in these final few classes in groups of four, they have to walk the rest of the class through a Kristen Linklater warm-up. And one student yesterday, she will know who she is if she listens to this, just, like, totally owned the articulators part of the Linklater warm-up and clearly took such pleasure and joy and time to walk us through this, and even did things that were in the book and in the training, but that I had not made time for teaching in class.
Mm-hmm.
And to see, to witness a 18, 19-year-old make the work her own and be able to teach it with that much pleasure was joyful.
Mm.
And then today, one other example, I teach theater imagination with my colleague Shannon. And at the end, we ask them to do the impossible, which is to put together a whole show. So in this case,
wow,
there's 25 of them, and they each have to do a piece that's up to 3 minutes long. But then the whole thing has to gel, not so much thematically, but, like, logistically. Like, the transitions have to be figured out, the lights up, lights down,
got
the
it.
Sound. They all have to help each other.
Interesting.
And this was their final rehearsal today for in preparation for their performance this week, and they were so organized as a group of 25. And when there's 25, there need to be leaders. There was 2, 3, 4 leaders who were running the show, but everyone was collaborating. No one lost their shit. We were in another room just listening. They had a timeline. They had an order. They were taking care of each other. They were doing the work.
Mm.
And I don't think, like, maybe as teachers, we can take a tiny bit of credit for that, but But they made that happen. And to see this group at a, you know, it's an intro level theater course, succeed in collaborating as 25 people, that was extraordinary. So those things energize me, where you like, I'm going to try and teach you a thing, and then you actually are owning it.
Yeah.
Like, you get it. You know, that's our goal, right?
Totally.
Yeah.
Totally. And just to give yourself a little bit more credit, I mean, that's that same class that you talked about. That's the same class that is meant to be a, like, getting people in the creative habit. And
yeah.
So you're creating the circumstances that that happens in.
Hopefully.
Yeah.
Yeah. We'll take a little bit of credit, sure.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think that same group of people would have spontaneously been able to do that if you had just said, like, here's your goal.
Right.
Go,
see right.
you in 10 weeks.
Right. It was a collaboration between the teachers and the students.
That's wonderful.
Yeah.
That's wonderful. That's all I have.
All right. Thank you.
This is really fun.
Yeah.
I like chatting with you.
Yeah, me too.
I feel like our friendship is deeper than might be apparent when people just hear us discuss in a more focused way on the podcast. And so I think it's nice to be able to, like, in some ways bring some of the conversations we've had off the air onto the air. But also most of the stuff we talked about is stuff that we've never really actually talked to each other about before.
No, it's been great. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah. All right, bye.
Bye.
We are forever grateful to Ricky Jumper, our audio engineer, who sits in the other room and records us as we do this. And thank you also to Jonathan Howard, who takes that raw audio and turns it into a proper podcast episode, and who also designs our website and all things tech.
Yes.
Thank you both.
Thank you both.